that if we continued with American history at the pace we're going right now, by the time we got to 1995, it would be part of American history, because we'll be doing this for years. And so what we have decided to do, I think, is at this point, after we finish up today with the War of 1812, we're probably just going to skim as quickly as possible and highlight several things. We're going to highlight, of course, the major wars and some of the major decisions made, and try to breeze right on through. I literally have enough for a year and a half on the Civil War, and probably that much more on World War II, and half that much on World War I. So we're going to try to move ahead as quickly as we can. It was not my intention to teach you every detail of American history when we started out, but it's kind of it's been interesting to me, so I get carried away. You'll have to pardon me. I just enjoy studying history. So we're going to move just to what we call kind of a highlight format, and I think I'm going to supply you with some maps and give you some ideas of some of the wars and how they were fought and what the determinations of those wars were. Really, to be honest with you, you can trace the history of just about any nation with two things. One is the history of its warfare, and number two is the history of its morality. If you trace those two things, you'll have the history of any nation. And so we're going to kind of try to accelerate the pace just a bit, and you come with your thinking cap on, ready to go, and we'll move ahead. Now, we are looking at the War of 1812. The War of 1812 is an interesting war in several respects. It's a very important war, but it's a very unnecessary war. And as a matter of fact, it's kind of a stupid war, all things considered, that we'll look at. Of course, Washington serves as president for two terms in the United States. And following Washington comes Adams, and he serves for a term. Who is Adams' vice president? Anybody remember? Thomas Jefferson is Adams' vice president, even though they're from two different political parties. And we mentioned the fact that was the first problem with the electoral system, is that the two men running against each other were Adams and Jefferson, and one won the election and the other was made vice president. Doesn't make for a very good, unity in the government at all, but Jefferson serves as vice president. Following that term, Jefferson is elected for two terms as president of the United States, and in the first election of Thomas Jefferson, his running mate tied with him. You remember, because of another problem with the electoral system, Jefferson and his vice president tied for the presidency, and it took 36 ballots before Jefferson was finally elected president over his vice president. I'm sure that also didn't make for a very good relationship in Washington political parties. But Jefferson serves two terms. We've mentioned and talked about Jefferson's viewpoints. Jefferson was a patriot, I believe. I do not believe the man was a Christian. He probably is in hell right now. And as is the case of a lot of these fellows, the modern concept in religion, or at least in Christianity, is to make everybody a Christian if you can. You can sometimes, it's kind of like straining at a gnat in order to get it. You know, a guy mentions God in his memoirs, and that's it. Proof positive the guy was a Bible-believing Christian. Jefferson never made a claim to be a Christian. Jefferson, as a matter of fact, never even termed himself a deist, although he's been given credit for being a deist. Jefferson was never antagonistic, however, of religion. And that's what you need to remember, is that these men back here, even though they were lost and on their way to hell, were Bible-believing individuals. Dr. Ruckman said one time, I'll never forget this, he said that the great change that he had seen since the beginning of his ministry and where he was today was the fact that people had stopped believing the Bible. And he said years ago, 40, 50 years ago in America, even lost people believed the Bible was the Word of God. And they had some respect for it. They had some respect for morality, and that's all but gone now. So we tend to, when we talk about a fellow not being saved, we tend to associate him with the heathen of our day and time, or those who are antagonists of Christianity, and that was not the case. Jefferson said, I think I read to you several times, that he believed that the best form of morality any nation could ever grasp was the morality that was taught by Jesus Christ, and he had high regard for Jesus Christ. He read the Bible and those things, but to make him a Christian would be to do a disservice, I think, to the cross of Jesus Christ. I do not believe he was a Christian, do not believe he was saved. But again, let me emphasize the fact he was a very moral man, a very biblical man. Okay, and that's not a contrast in terms, because those people were biblical in their nature. They were morally biblical, or biblically moral, whichever way you want to term it. And as we get up to the days of Jefferson, particularly his second term, America's policy, as is the case, usually was influenced by the policies of nations across the sea. America is a fledgling nation. America is just beginning. And there are some real problems in this early American government, and we've come through a lot of those. Our Constitution was not as easily accepted as we've been led to believe. As a matter of fact, it nearly fell, into disapproval by the original states, and was nearly rejected without the Bill of Rights. There was a lot of work that went on, a lot of work that took place in order to hammer out a compromise so that that document could become the founding document of this nation. And America was faced with problems in respect of expanding and expanding its territory. It had basically the sea to the east and the Indians and mountains to the west. And the Indians were not always on peaceable terms. There was conflicts continually. America did not have a great military as it does now. The Revolutionary War was fought with what we call militias, state militias. And those militias were trained on local levels. They were trained in churches and in businesses all across this nation. There was no such thing as the United States Army that had military bases everywhere. Those militias came together, the Minutemen came together and formed the first army that America had. Following the Revolutionary War, most of those soldiers went back to their homes. They went back to their farms, and they hung their muskets back up over the fireplace and got out the plow and went back to work like they always did. America did not have a large supported army. And when the Indian uprisings would come, the militia would have to band together again and train a little bit and go out to fight the Indians. Oftentimes they were defeated because they were unprepared. But that's the type of America that Jefferson was governing or attempting to pull together and make into a nation. Jefferson had some problems with Adams. Adams was a Federalist and Jefferson was not. Adams was pro the notion that the strongest form of government was a strong central federal government that controlled everything. Jefferson, on the contrary, believed that the individual states held the rights and that the federal government existed solely to serve the states and their purposes and carry out their purposes. So a disagreement of opinions, Adams went one way, and then when Jefferson came into power, he took it back the other way. And when you're going two different directions, you're not making much headway as a nation. All of those things contributed to bring us to 1812, where the War of 1812 broke out. The War of 1812 actually didn't have any reason to begin. It was a cast to America from what was going on in Europe. Napoleon had arisen, and Napoleon was out for conquest. And you remember we talked about the two favorite warring countries have always been England and France. They love to fight. They probably fought more total years of warfare than any other nations on the face of the earth. It didn't take much. They're only 20 miles apart there across the English Channel. And really, they could almost holler across the channel. And when they hollered the wrong thing, war started. And that's basically the way it happened. You tried to sail two ships in there side by side through the channel, and they bumped into each other, and a war would start. We make a lot of fun of the Germans because of the last two world wars, but prior to that, there was no comparison between the war minds that were in England as well as in France. War breaks out between Napoleon and the British Crown. And in so doing, America reaps some advantages. because in the warfare that took place, you remember that Napoleon had designs on ruling the entire world. Napoleon believed himself to be the next in order to rule the world behind the Caesars and whatnot. And it is reported, and we were talking about it last night. Who was I talking to about that spear of Longimanus? I was talking to somebody. There is a spear that, and I just throw this in because it's interesting. Supposedly, it was the spear that pierced Christ's side. Now, you say, do you believe that? Not really. But I know this. I know that the greatest wars that have been fought over possession of that spear. Napoleon had it. He took it from the Caesars. And after Napoleon had it, Adolf Hitler had it. And I've seen it. It's in the Hofburg Palace in Austria. It's about yay long, just the spearhead. And that spear, Hitler killed I don't know how many men to get that thing. And held it the whole time he was in power. And there's among these leaders, there's some kind of a sinister spirit about the thing. And I don't know. I think Dr. Ruckman ran a thing on it one time. He named five rulers that have held that spear, that have gone after world, men that were after world conquest. They've all had it. And five of them had it, and now it's in a palace over there waiting on number six to come and get it. And if that's true, if there's anything to that, the next man that gets it will be number six. He'll be the Antichrist, probably. And I don't know. I just threw that out there. I thought it'd be interesting, you know. You say, what, stranger than fiction? Or, you know, maybe so. I don't know. But there it is. And but Napoleon's up. He's trying to secure his power there. But he also has designs on not just controlling Europe, but the entire world. Therefore, his goal is to establish something in the United States of America. Remember, if you will, France claimed all of the land that really from our western border, which at that time was really from about the, if you take the point of Ohio, where it comes down the Ohio River there and goes south, everything to the west, France was claiming all the way to the Mississippi. And Jefferson, realizing that, began negotiations with the French government for the port of New Orleans. He realized that as Americans expanded to the west, they would need some way to transport whatever they produced, whatever they grew. If there was going to be any promise of that expansion, they needed some way to get their goods, the crops, whatever, to the markets and to the export stations that were along the East Coast. So Jefferson began to negotiate with the French government for the port of New Orleans, realizing that that would hold the Mississippi River open for the barges and shipment of grain and that type of stuff, and would allow them to leave the Midwest part of this country and move around to the East Coast. He had been given a right, I can't remember the figures right now because they're in my notes from last week, but he'd been given a right to spend so much money on the port of New Orleans, and as he began to negotiate, Napoleon basically sold him what we now call the Louisiana Territory. And the Louisiana Territory stretched all the way from the port of New Orleans into Canada. Basically, he sold him the whole Mississippi River Basin as far over as Wyoming to the west. All the land basically that France had laid a claim to was sold to the United States of America. However, Jefferson paid a little more for it than he'd been authorized to pay for it, and he got in some trouble here. One of the first great, I don't know whether that was Jefferson Gate or what that was, but somewhere along the line he got in trouble. We recognize that now as probably the greatest bargain we ever got. Next to that would be the purchase of Alaska, but those two purchases right there, we got a real bargain, and we could literally say that France didn't know what it was doing when it sold us all that property. Can you imagine if the United States was divided into two halves today with the country of France right in the middle? Could have been that way. So we made that purchase. England and France are at war. Napoleon is fighting the British crown. The British crown is fighting Napoleon. Back and forth they go. And what begins to arise is this. Each of them begin to compete for what little trade there is from the 13 states. And the United States then begins to see its own shipping industry and export industry hampered by the fact that when we were on good terms with France, England would attack our ships. When we were on good terms with England, France would attack our ships. It was a situation, catch-22, we couldn't win. No matter who we agreed to trade with, the other one would come after us, and we would get into trouble. And so Jefferson put into existence what he called a Jefferson's Embargo Act. And the Embargo Act basically did this. It stopped all American exports, period. The idea was, you don't like it? Fine. We're not going to ship anything else out of our country. That's it. We're done. Finished. Not sending anything out. It was a good idea, other than the fact that it was a bad idea. And the reason it was a bad idea was this. Same thing's true now. We tend to get the idea that, well, you know, we need to stop trading with the Japanese. We need to stop trading with these people and cut them down. And America would collapse in 24 hours if we stopped our foreign trade. Literally, we would collapse within 24 hours. You and I just, you'd have to sit down and look at the figures to realize the scope of what Americans' foreign trade is. Now, to be honest with you, I'd just soon let the rest of the world go. You know, somebody talks bad about my country, hey, cut them off. Don't sell them anything. Stop selling them everything. Stop selling them goods. And that'd be wonderful, except for the fact that about 60% of all American industry is linked to foreign trade. Now, let's just soak that in for a minute. If 60% of American industry is linked to foreign trade and we stopped all foreign trade tomorrow, that means 60% of people in this church wouldn't have a job in the morning. If 60% of the people in this country lost their job overnight, that means that 60% of the goods purchased in this country domestically would stop tomorrow morning, which means that 60% of the domestic trade in this country would stop before tomorrow afternoon, which means we'd have a major upheaval in a matter of 24 hours. It can't be done. And I'm not preaching and I'm not espousing global economics. I'm not talking about a one world government or anything like that. But, you know, we tend sometimes to look at the way the Antichrist moves and establishes his kingdom as sinister and sneaky. You know, we say, well, they have to sneak in. They're not sneaking in anywhere. This idea of a one world government and a new age thing is catching hold. I mean, it's just like a wildfire. And the people in Washington are grabbing hold of it. They're espousing it. Even, you know, we say, well, we put the Republicans up. It doesn't make any difference who you put up there. Because the truth of the matter is that a global economy is inevitable. Okay, now I realize that's real slanderous to an American patriotic mind. A global economy is inevitable. And you're not going to deter it, neither am I. As a matter of fact, it is not unbiblical. When Jesus Christ sets up his kingdom in Jerusalem, what does he rule? He rules the world. It's a global economy, you see. We kind of espoused this nationalistic idea and held on to it. And God bless America, and I love my country, and I'm a patriot. And I wish we could just cut it all off. And when somebody snubbed their nose at us, say, hey, you know, on your own, take care of yourself. We can't do that. We're hung up in this idea of globalism. But the idea is this. What the Antichrist does is not sinister and sneaky. It's brilliant. You know, we sometimes think the Antichrist is just some dummy that, you know, he's sitting in there looking at a Ouija board and, you know, some lady with a turban on her head and a feather in her cap kind of telling him which way to go. Listen, the Antichrist, biblically, is absolutely, globally, militarily, economically, a genius. And what he does is, for the first time in the history of man, organizes a world, a true worldwide empire that functions. He'll do it. The idea of, well, you know, computers are of the Antichrist and the devil's going to use computers, and boy, they're moving quick. Somebody put some articles in my office this week about the cashless economy that is on the verge now. They're giving you a debit card. Your ATM card is going to eliminate checks, they say, within the next 5 years. You won't get any checks anymore. There'll be no more checks. You'll take your ATM card when you go to the grocery store and zip it through, and whatever you buy in groceries, they deduct it right there out of your account. And just a few steps beyond that, there'll be no currency in circulation. And, oh, you know, we say how ungodly and how, you know, there's nothing ungodly about that at all. Folks, that's brilliant. That's absolutely brilliant. You eliminate crime as you go. I mean, if you don't have any money, who's going to rob you? I mean, you look at all the banking fiascos and the savings and loan fiascos we've had in the last few years. I mean, if you eliminate cash and everything goes to just a debit account and you don't even have to call it money anymore. I think in Orwell's book, 1984, you work for credits. You know, you say, well, that sounds communist to me. It doesn't matter what you call it. I mean, you can call it dollar, credit's worth as much as a dollar is. All it is a mark of currency. It's a mark of trade. So you may work someday, instead of making $400 a week, you may make 400 credits applied to your account. And you may use your debit card, and it may cost you a tenth of a credit to buy this or 15 credits to buy that. And you say, well, it's brilliant. These talk about putting a mark in the hand or in the forehead. Now the idea is the computer chip and that can be scanned. That's absolutely brilliant. I mean, if you've been in an automobile accident, you're laying out here beside the car, they don't know how to treat you, what your medical records are, isn't it nice to know they can scan a microchip in your hand and instantly come up with who you are, who your doctor is, what you're allergic to, how to treat you, what hospital you want to go to, what kind of insurance you've got, if you don't have any, Hillary will kick in. All of that stuff in just a second can be accessed. That's brilliant. The Antichrist is not some bozo. The Antichrist is absolutely, as far as the world is concerned, as far as a human being is concerned, probably the most intelligent human being that has ever lived on the face of the earth. Absolutely brilliant. The only problem is he's a tool of the devil. But when the Lord establishes his kingdom, he establishes a global kingdom. He rules from Jerusalem. With a rod of iron. So we're headed, it is inevitable that the world will move to a global economy. And I don't think it's so terrible myself anymore, because it just proves to me the Lord's coming back soon. And let it go, you know. Jefferson was a lot like you and I. Jefferson said, hey, we won't do that. Forget it. We won't trade with anybody. And Jefferson was the first president, the first politician to make that mistake. Because in just a matter of a few months, he nearly destroyed the United States economy. As a matter of fact, so much so that there was talk of secession by several states. There were several states that talked about impeaching him and getting rid of him because of the difficulty that was created in the economy of the United States when Jefferson refused to carry out trade with any foreign government. As a matter of fact, that embargo act was repealed just about 5 days before Jefferson left office in 1899. Jefferson was ready to retire, and the Congress figured it would do him no disservice, and they repealed the embargo act and again opened the door for some type of trade. At the close of Jefferson's career, Madison is elected president of the United States. You've heard of Dolly Madison, okay? She didn't just bake cakes. She was the first lady. It's kind of amazing. They make fun of us, or don't make fun of us, they get real angry at us for making fun of Hillary. But you look into the past at all the first ladies they've made fun of. You know, they had a riot with Nancy Reagan. I don't know what the difference would be, you know, other than somebody's a little upset with you. But Madison comes into office and he was Jefferson's pick or appointed successor. He came in on Jefferson's recommendation and continues basically the policies of Jefferson, although he is a little more of a moderate than Jefferson had been. And the first problem that he's faced is the war now between England and France and America's involvement, desire to stay neutral, but inability to do that. And when we get here in just a moment, the War of 1812 really is a war begun over a fight for neutrality. I mean, what a thought. You know, we want to be neutral, and we want to be neutral so bad we're going to fight both of you. We go to war to be neutral, whatever it was. But Madison puts in a couple of bills to replace Jefferson's Embargo Act, hoping to moderate and solve the problem. The first is called a Non-Intercourse Act. And what that does, it opens American trade with everybody but France and England. It says we're going to trade with everybody, but it is illegal to trade with France and England. Well, only one small problem with that. Those were the two guys that were attacking you in the first place. And so now, once instead of having one or the other coming after you, now you got both of them coming after you. And so that doesn't work real well. Following the heels of that comes what we call the Macon Bill. And the Macon Bill was a stroke of genius that never really panned out as well, because the Macon Bill said, all right, let's let them fight it out with each other. The Macon Bill said that America is going to reestablish trade with whichever country honors our neutrality. In other words, we're going to pick one of the two of you guys, and the one we're going to pick to trade with is the one that leaves us alone. And the hope was that that we would throw everything back into the lap of these two countries and let them hash it out, and while they were, we would really be unhampered on the seas. And what happened then, basically, was what resulted in the War of 1812. Napoleon made a bold, brilliant statement. He saw it as a way to forward his cause, and he made several great statements about how friendly France was to the United States and how he loved the American people and how he wanted to see the Americans prosper. Truth of the matter was, France was attacking as many American ships as England was at the time. But because of his statements, the President and Congress were under obligation because of this bill. And so they sent word to England that they were going to cease trade with England and were going to reestablish trade with France. And basically, England put down the sanctions on the United States. They began to impress American seamen into British service. They began to seize American naval vessels really in earnest and pushed us to the brink of the War of 1812. One other thing, one other stroke that caused the straw, I guess, or was the straw that broke the camel's back, was in the Northwest Territory, in which you and I live right now. The Northwest Territory, of course, had been the place where, as the expansion of the states had occurred, settlers had begun to migrate toward the west, and as they did, they were pushing the Indians. The Indians, of course, chose not to adapt themselves to a white man's society, and that's the freedom of choice. But as that white man's society continued to move westward, in order to be out in the country, they had to go further out into the country, and was almost continually on the move. And about that time, you and I live in the wild, wild west. There never was as much bloodshed anywhere west of the Mississippi as what there was right here. The Comanches and the Sioux, a bunch of crackers compared to the guys that fought right here in this part of the country. And a fellow from down near Zanesville, Ohio, as a matter of fact, although at that time it wasn't Zanesville, Ohio, it was wide open wilderness, and his name was Tecumseh. He was a Shawnee Indian. How many of you have ever been down and seen the thing on Tecumseh down there? Tecumseh was a Shawnee Indian, and the Moravians had gone in to win the Indians to the Lord years and years before that, before America was even a nation. I think it's Simon Kenton in his book, The Frontiersman, I believe, is the first book that is the story of Simon Kenton. And he actually has the first message that was ever preached to the Indians along the Ohio River Valley by the Moravians. And an entire village of the Shawnee Indians had accepted the Lord as their Savior. They'd gotten saved. And the Moravians were really the missionary impetus for years and years and years. They were the ones that suffered and were killed. And anyway, they won an entire Indian village to Christ, and this village decided to lay down their weapons of war, decided not to attack white men and people anymore, and basically began to live a peaceful life. The preachers were there, they had a church, and it was down close to Zanesville. And several years following that, there was a raid in Pennsylvania, western Pennsylvania, in which a settler's wife and children were massacred, and they were scalped and all that kind of stuff, the atrocities that took place there. And there was a British general that organized the militia and set out for revenge. And he headed on over into Ohio looking for the Shawnee that had committed the atrocities. And as he got into Ohio, he made several captives, and those captives told him there was a tribe that had laid down their weapons of war and had adapted the ways of Christianity and were no longer fighters. And this British general, in order to forward his cause, marched in and killed every Indian in that village, claiming they were the ones that committed the atrocities. Actually, it was an easy kill. and went in, lined these Indians up around the wall of the longhouse in which they lived, and massacred every one of them, and killed them all. Well, Tecumseh was just a little boy about that time, and Tecumseh never forgot that. Tecumseh hated the white man from the very days of his youth, and as he grew, he became the chief of the Shawnee. And now, at this point, about 1811, 1812, Tecumseh sees the inevitable. His brother is called the Prophet, strangely enough. He's a medicine man. And Tecumseh and his brother begin to formulate a plan to rid their land of the white man. And their idea is a confederacy of all of the Indian tribes, and there are many, many Indian tribes. I would guess maybe up in the area of 1,000 tribes that inhabited the area east of the Mississippi River at one time. And Tecumseh's desire is to pull all those Indians together and to force the white man to leave. And as his confederacy begins to grow, of course, the settlers get word of it, and they begin to realize what's going on. And right here in this area, the battles begin to be fought. We talked about the Battle of Fallen Timbers, fought less than 2 miles from here several weeks ago. You live really in a very famous historical area from early America and early Americana. But over around the Indiana area, southern tip of Indiana down there, this was where the center of all of this confederacy was coming together, a place down there called Tippecanoe. And it was at Tippecanoe that William Henry Harrison repelled an attack and literally just kind of crushed the forming of that confederacy. He didn't stop it. But he really gave them a major setback when they attacked the settlers there, and the settlers just really made havoc of them. But what happened is when word got back to the eastern seaboard that the Indians were formulating a confederacy and that Harrison had really temporarily put them out of commission, the idea immediately became formulated that it was the British that were, they were encouraging this because they had their designs on taking America back. They were taking the shipping there, they were attacking the Americans on the high seas, and now they were inciting the Indians to the west to revolt and rebel. And because of that, ideas were formulated as to what we were going to do. And of course, the idea, of course, was for war. The unknown thing, or most people don't know, is that the War of 1812 was totally unnecessary. We declared war on June the 18th, 1812. That's when Congress declared war on Britain. But realizing communication was not what it is today, there were several things we did not know. And what we did not know is that the British Parliament on June 16, 1812, had revoked all of their orders to attack American shipping. They had basically decided to adopt a policy of being friendly. And they had announced on June the 16th that beginning June the 23rd, their policies toward the United States were going to change, and they were going to adopt a friendly policy with the United States. So between the 16th and the 23rd, that's all we would have had to wait, and things would have been fine. But on the 18th, we declared war on Britain. And so we fought a totally unnecessary war. Everything that we wanted, they had just given us 2 days before. We just wanted them to leave us alone. We wanted to be neutral. And on the 16th of June, England agreed with that. They agreed that America was neutral, but by then we decided not to be neutral anymore, and we decided to fight a war. And so we went to war. was not the time to fight a war. As I said, most of the militia had gone home. Those men that had been lieutenants and captains and sergeants and privates in the war were now farmers and raising cattle, and the call again went out for the militias to arm. And the idea at the very beginning was that America was going to take Canada away from the British. That was the design of those who decided we're going to go to war. If you're going to go to war, you've got to have a victory. You've got to have a goal. And so the goal was the taking of Canada by the United States of America. Thank the Lord that didn't pan out quite that way. That was the design. And I don't know exactly who was in command or who was in control, but it was obviously what we would call today an armchair general. And he set up this plan. There were so few British troops in all of Canada. They were spread so thin. Now, they were still here. Remember, I told you that after the Revolutionary War, the British had not unmanned their forts. There were still some British forts in the United States that were manned by British troops in violation of the treaty, but really they weren't much of a threat. I mean, you know, 20 men in a fort out in the back end of nowhere with no way of gaining supplies, they really don't constitute an enemy threat. And so we really hadn't said much about it. And literally, honestly, there were so few British troops that had we made a concentrated effort in invading Canada, we could have taken it virtually unopposed. Most of the force we were going to attack had less than several hundred men, and we could have easily, if we'd put a force together, taken those forts. But some brilliant general got an idea of, rather than leaving Fort Detroit with one massive army and marching up the St. Lawrence and taking fort after fort after fort, it would be much better to launch a three-pronged attack, you know, great pincer movement and all that kind of stuff. Some, you know, military strategist decided that what we'll do is we'll attack from Detroit with one-third of our force, and we'll attack across from New York there at Niagara, we'll attack with another third of our force, and then with yet another third of our force, we'll go across what is Lake Champlain, and we'll get some, you know, three different ways. It'll just be a beautiful strategy, and we'll win the war. The only problem was, by the time we got our army divided into thirds, there wasn't enough to do anything. And one part of the army was delayed. It was going to be this brilliant simultaneous move up there and the taking of all these forts. One army got delayed and decided to wait till after the winter before they got started, you know, so they were 2 or 3 months behind the other armies, couldn't get supplies. And basically what happened is we never even got off the ground. As a matter of fact, the British then organized their forces and marched down the St. Lawrence and came to what was Fort Detroit. And Hull was the commander at Fort Detroit, and basically Hull surrendered the fort without a shot being fired. When he saw the British coming, he decided to check out and decided just give them the fort, basically. So now, once this army that we're going to conquer Canada now have invaded our greatest fort in the Northwest and now own the fort, and the Americans have been driven out. Spurred on by the British victory, the Indians then take what was called Fort Dearborn. Anybody know where Fort Dearborn was? What city stands where Fort Dearborn was? I knew you'd say that. Chicago, Illinois. And the Indians proceeded to take Chicago, Illinois, and not nearly as, generous as the British were, they massacred every settler at Fort Dearborn. They killed everybody that was there. And now the two northwestern forts to protect our country are in the hands of our enemies. It's a great way to start a war, don't you think? And America basically is in major trouble. So war is declared, the shots are fired, we lose Fort Detroit immediately, and then we lose as well Fort Dearborn, which is over in Chicago. All right. In 1813, the thing that turned the tide, we were fixing to lose big time. And again, come back to focus right here in this area. There was a fellow that, I think America only had 17 warships at the time the war broke out, which is not really what you would classify a formidable navy, considering we were going against the mightiest navy on the face of the earth, which was the British, the man of war, the most feared ship that there was anywhere. And so we really didn't stand much of a chance. And the idea was that we had to interrupt the British shipping down through the St. Lawrence that were supplying the forts not only of Canada, but now of Detroit and Fort Dearborn. Something had to be done. And the fellow's name was Perry, Commodore Perry. And the reason he was called a Commodore is because a Commodore is a commander without a navy, basically, you know. That's kind of like an admiral without any ships, and he's a Commodore. And he has the ability to lead, but he just doesn't have any boats. And so Commodore Perry was put in charge of the Erie Division of the United States Navy. And I'm sure they would have given him some warships, but for the fact that they couldn't get any down the St. Lawrence Seaway and into the Erie, Lake Erie, so he was just a commodore. And Perry, though, was a genius. Perry went over to Erie, Pennsylvania, and his men began to cut down wood out of the forest, and it was not long before they had built themselves some ships. And with those ships, they launched out into Lake Erie, and it was very near this area right here, where in 1813, I believe, Perry defeated the British forces in what was called the Battle of Lake Erie. And, of course, Perrysburg, right down here, is a statue of Commodore Perry there overlooking the Maumee River. And he has a monument out on, what's the island out there? Put-in Bay, which is right where the battle took place. Perry's strategy was to hide behind the islands. And he would hide because he could not outrun the British and he couldn't outgun the British. So what he would do is he would creep in behind the islands and hide until the British had sailed into an unfortunate position, launch out an attack, and then sail back to the safety and hide behind the islands. A brilliant strategy. He won. And basically that turned the tide as far as the Northwest Territory was concerned. Although we still weren't in control of it, we at least controlled the lakes, and that would eventually lead to a victory. I mean, the Northwest Territory was owned by the British. When he defeated the British Navy, William Henry Harrison was notified by Perry, of course, the famous statement, "We have met the enemy and he is ours." That was made from right out here somewhere in the middle of the lake. I don't know exactly where, West Sister Island. He's probably walleye fishing or something. But he sent words to William Henry Harrison that we have met the enemy and he is ours, meaning that they had conquered whatever there was of the British Navy was now under the American control. That encouraged Harrison to launch an invasion to try and take Detroit back. And this will give you an idea of how thin the British forces were. When the British saw Harrison coming to take Detroit back, they basically gave it back. I mean, you know, here's a fort that changed hands several times, largely without too many shots being fired, because there just weren't enough men to try and defend anything. And so the British took off, and they commenced running and running away from Harrison, and Harrison is in pursuit. And at this point, in a battle that took place not far after they had routed the fort, Tecumseh is killed. And when Tecumseh is killed, the Confederacy of the Indian Nations is destroyed. The Indians have lost their will to fight, and again, the tide turns in favor of the American forces. And so when Tecumseh dies, the Northwest really falls back into the hands or the control of the United States, and it stays that way. The battle in Canada, however, as they are proceeding up into the Canadian territory, again, with the idea of taking Canada as an American possession. And on up into 1814, the battle took place. The Americans really had a number of great victories in Canada. They routed the British several times, and they were defeated one time, and then they would come back and win again. But by 1814, basically, everything had just kind of come to a standstill. And it was almost like, you know, one fort, the guy get up and fire a shot, symbolic shot every morning at the other fort, and then they'd all go back about their day-to-day chores. Because there wasn't much warfare going on. It just kind of had settled out to nothing, a stalemate. And a strange thing, not a strange thing, but an interesting thing for the British government happened, and that was the Battle of Waterloo. What happened at Waterloo? So I just love the knowledge of history we have. Yeah, that one. Napoleon was defeated at Waterloo. Now, what had been going on over in Europe? A war, the Napoleonic Wars, the war between France and England. Napoleon is defeated. Now then, there is no longer any war going on over there. So when a war is over, what do you always have a surplus of? Army, soldiers. So at the end of this war, Britain now can push its forces back into this war over here. And it was not long before British forces were building up here, and in 1814, 11,000 British regulars cross Lake Champlain into western New York. And the idea is now to fight this war to the end and for Britain to take back what she feels she's been denied of in an earlier war. And across they come. They launch a front there across the St. Lawrence down into western New York. And there was one fellow there by the name of Captain McDonough. And Captain McDonough organized the militia and the people that were thereabouts. And strangely enough, they repelled the British invasion. And it was really actually a greater victory than any victory we'd ever won. Even in the Revolutionary War, we'd never won such a victory. This was a surprise attack. They were vastly outnumbered, and they really weren't ready to fight too much. But whatever it was McDonough did, he got them ready to fight, and they repelled the British invasion. What happened at that point was the Americans gave up the idea of conquering Canada. They now realized they'd be lucky to get out of this thing with their shirt. And so they gave up the idea of attacking the Canadian frontier. But also, because the British had been so humiliated, they decided not to push to take the Northwest Territory back again. They just kind of said, okay, that's it. And now there would be a couple other battles, and basically the war is going to begin to wind down to an end. But several things take place that are of interest in the history of this country. One of them is the fact that Washington, D.C. is attacked by a surprise invasion of the British. And when they finally counted, there were 7,000 American troops there to defend the nation's capital. They only had 7,000 men. The British began to unload their ships, began to march ashore, and that was the first time, and as far as I know, maybe the only time, that the President of the United States was on the front lines of the battle. He rode, got on his horse and rode out to where the British were coming up the ridge there, and actually was on the front lines of the battle for a period of time. They are not too happy about letting the President of the United States do that anymore. They try to keep him back from the front lines. But Madison went out and surveyed the situation. He realized that the attempt to defend Washington was futile, and went back, got his wife, family, and they began to collect all the important documents of the American government they could, the Congress working together, trying to grab all of the legislation. Somebody thought to grab the Constitution, and here they go. They took off. The British were so close on their heels that the British officers that ruled the British Army actually ate dinner in the White House. And they ate the meal that they had cooked, the people had prepared for Madison and his family. So that's how close they were. The British came right in. Madison was going out the back door as they were coming in the front door. And so they sat down and ate Madison's dinner, basically, and had a good meal. They decided, they knew they couldn't hold anything. They didn't have enough men. Again, they were just slim pickings. And they decided they couldn't hold it, and it's not really sure whether they even wanted to. Some have said that what they wanted to do was to have reprisals for what the Americans had done up in Montreal and Toronto, where they had gone in and burned government buildings and ransacked towns during their victories. So they took all the furniture in the White House and piled it up into one nice, neat little pile and lit it on fire, proceeded to burn the White House down. And there was no capital at this time. That was kind of the center of government. They just decided to burn it to the ground, and then they evacuated. They left. And they had evidently succeeded in what they wanted to do, showed us that they could do it, and they decided to leave. Following on the heels of that victory, they decided to attack down the river a little bit in the Chesapeake Bay. They were going to attack Baltimore. And as they sailed into Chesapeake Bay, they encountered a fort that became very famous in the history of our history here, or our country. They came to Fort McHenry, which overlooks the Chesapeake Bay, protects the city of Baltimore, and the warship sailed in there. The ultimatum was given that they were going to attack the fort, and the fort had so much time to evacuate, and then it would fall into British hands. And, of course, the one thing Americans have in their favor is we're bullheaded. I mean, sometimes I don't know how smart we are, but we're bullheaded. And the Americans decided this was the place they were going to stand off the British Navy. And they held on there. You remember how the warfare took place all night. There was a lawyer, and his name was Key. And Key had been dispatched by Madison to the head of the British Navy in order to secure a prisoner exchange. Now remember, the war had been going on for 2 or 3 years here. Prisoners have been taken by both sides, and really prisoners of war are not all that conducive to winning the war. They're more of a burden. When you've got to feed all your prisoners of war and you've got to take care of them, they become a burden. So Madison had approached the British government and directly the commander of the British Navy about an exchange of prisoners. He had gone to oversee that prisoner exchange. He had gone down into the brig of some of those men of war and seen there the really the emaciated bodies of American seamen and soldiers that had been captured. And he wrote about it later on and talked about the terrible conditions that these individuals had been kept under, most of them dying with some diseases and whatnot. And he went down and began to explain to them that he had come to set them free. I think it was David Gibbs has a story along this line. But as he began to talk about how he had gone to negotiate for the release of these prisoners, the British government had stated they would allow those prisoners to go in exchange for their own prisoners with one condition, and that was the prisoners were to be taken home back to their farms, back to their families. The war was over for them. And as Key went down into the hold and began to relate that message to these prisoners, they told Key this. They said, if we cannot fight anymore, we don't want to go home. They said, we are here to fight for our country. We're here to defend our country. And if you can get our release, that's well and good. But if that release comes only at a promise that we will not fight anymore, then let us stay here. And so as Key was on that ship trying to secure that release, he began to notice the other men of war that began to sail into the harbor there. And before long, it was just British everywhere. And they began to bombard Fort McHenry. And as McHenry was bombarded throughout the night, Key stood there on the deck of that ship and watched that bombardment. Of course, that gave birth to the national anthem of the United States of America. And he talked about in the morning, you know, what so proudly we hailed at the dawn's, you know, the flag was still there. And they had not brought down the flag. But what had happened is there was on a wooden standard at Fort McHenry, and during the bombardment, several times during the night, that standard had been knocked loose and had fallen. But each time, Henry said, before the flag could fall to the ground, an American soldier would rush out and push it back up. And those men began to get killed trying to hold that flagstaff up. And he said that in the morning, there was literally a mound of American bodies holding that flagstaff secure at the base so that it wouldn't fall. And that's what prompted him to write what became the national anthem of the United States of America. So the War of 1812 did give birth to our national anthem. It was a totally unnecessary war. It was not needed. It was a war that needed not have happened, and yet it did. One other thing, and of course we've used the name William Henry Harrison, who was a general fighting for the United States. Later on, he is going to become what? A president of the United States. And not only that, but down in the South, the British had designs on taking New Orleans. You see, they wanted to take the Northwest Territory, they wanted to take the Eastern Seaboard, they wanted to take the southern part of the country and basically bottle up the nation. And down in the southern part of our country, there's a fellow down in there in Tennessee, a Tennessee fighter, Indian fighter, and his name was William Henry Harrison. And William Henry Harrison hears about the British attempt or design on taking New Orleans, and he sets out from Tennessee and makes his way down in through Georgia and Mississippi and Alabama and fights a battle down there in Mississippi and then heads over to New Orleans where he links up with his buddy Jean Lafitte, who is a French pirate. The French, remember, are at war with England. They can think of nothing better than fighting the British, and so they put their forces together. And they get all set. The British begin to disembark from the ships, and they put a formidable army out there ready to attack the city of New Orleans. But Harrison so prepares his men, and these were ragtag, we'd call them guerrillas. You know, this modern military we've got today, you know, it's all spit and polish and all that kind of. When Americans actually begin to fight wars, they get real ragtag. Some of you guys were in Vietnam, and you know that the Vietnam frontline soldiers did not look like Fort Benning, Georgia. They just, you know, spit and polish was gone. They had dirt in their hair, dirt in their eyes, dirt in their ears, dirt under their fingernails. They stunk, I mean, but they were tough to fight. And so Harrison took this ragtag bunch of men down there to New Orleans, and when the British finally made a frontal attack, in 30 minutes, 2,100 British soldiers were killed. That's the greatest loss the British ever had. I mean, he just literally whipped up on them. They only had like 6,000 troops, and he killed a third of them in less than 30 minutes. And as a matter of fact, when the British finally turned to run, they came out of the fort and went after them, and won what was the greatest victory in American history to that point. Was the Battle of New Orleans, and we won that battle. And again, it's kind of a strange thing. The War of 1812 was a strange war. And the strange thing about it was, the day before Harrison fought that war, the peace treaty had been signed in Europe, and the war actually was over. So he fought a battle and won a battle that needed not to have been fought. Remember, again, communication very slow, so we didn't find out about that for several weeks later. But Harrison, Old Hickory, becomes President of the United States. Two war heroes out of that war become President of the United States. Very quickly now, let me tell you some things that happened because of the War of 1812. And those of you that are just coming in and you're visitors, I apologize to you. This is not biblical studies in the sense that you might be used to. We're teaching the history of the United States of America because we have a godly heritage. But through the War of 1812, several things happened. Number one, the United States gained respect on the high seas. With those few ships that we had numerous victories. How many of you ever heard of the USS Constitution? Old Ironside. It was during the War of 1812 that Old Ironside's distinguished itself, sent to the bottom many British ship, and gained some recognition for the United States on the high seas. The idea was, after the War of 1812, you can't mess with America because they're going to fight. And the British, again, never challenged the United States in conquest of this country. We gained some respect. Number two, the war stimulated American industry. War always does that. And I'm convinced, and to be honest, I couldn't say anything definite, but we'll look at some things. I'm convinced two or three of the wars this country's fought have been fought because an economist decided we need to fight it. You never convinced me otherwise. I think we were taken into war several times just because our economy needed a stimulation a little bit. And, you know, what better way to get your economy rolling than to manufacture bullets and tanks and airplanes and all that kind of stuff. And an economist really does deals with dollars and dollar signs, not with human loss and human life. So it did stimulate an economy. A war always does that. And so the economy of the United States began to grow, America began to produce its products, and because of its victory, even new markets were open for trade. Number three, America basically became a nation. Prior to this, America had been 13 states, and 14 states, 15 states, I don't know how many there were at this point, but the few that had been added in the Northwest Territory. America was a loosely joined nation. There was not a spirit of nationalism. And for the first time in 1812, America had defeated an opponent, defeated its enemy. And the spirit of nationalism flooded through America, and America became a nation, really, for the first time in its history. And then finally, the War of 1812, because of the crushing of the Indian uprising, opened the doors for expansion westward. And in the next few years, the society of America, or the civilization of America, begins to literally pour in steady streams into the Midwest, and then even across the Mississippi River for settlement. And America begins to push.